As soon as we start talking about two people, we care less, in a sense, than we care about a single person. And by the time we're talking about a larger community or a society that is facing certain challenges, the human brain really struggles to comprehend what that means. And so, in a sense, we're doomed to compassion fatigue. It's built into the way our brains function.
Moin moin, dear listeners. Moin is the popular local greeting in Hamburg, Germany. Welcome to Nebelhorn, Hamburg Scientist for Future podcast. We are based here and introduced outstanding scientists or personalities who are engaged in creating a more sustainable future, either here in Hamburg or globally. Today, we introduce Scott Slavik because he helps us understand concepts like compassion and empathy. In this conversation, we mention Maria Carducci, who was our interview partner in the previous podcast. Maria, who is also based in Hamburg, has created a health app for people in Africa. Today we discuss why we should have compassion for people who live far away and the very human tendency to not show compassion or empathy beyond a certain distance, be it emotional or physical distance. In addition to this, or in addition to illuminating compassion and related concepts, we look at Scott Slavik's work, his current projects, and why he thinks it's crucial to keep planting intellectual seeds. Scott Slavik is currently University Distinguished Professor of Environmental Humanities at the University of Idaho in Moscow, U.S. But he lives in Eugene, Oregon, and he teaches his courses remotely over Zoom or as brief intensive sessions at the Wilderness Research Station in the Idaho Mountains. Scott was the founding president of the Association for the Study of Literature and Environment, known as ASLE, in the early 1990s, and he served a 25-year term as the editor-in-chief of ASLE's journal ILE, which stands for Interdisciplinary Studies in Literature and Environment. He did this from 1995 to 2020. Scott has published numerous books and has written numerous articles on American and international environmental literature, on the history of ecological literary studies, or ecocriticism, and on various issues of environmental communication and the psychology of information processing. He now co-edits the book series Routledge Studies in the World Literatures and Environment and Routledge Environmental Humanities, and he manages the website arithmeticofcompassion.org. Much of his work these days focuses on the challenges of communicating and apprehending information in the context of humanitarian and environmental crisis. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Heidi.
How is it going?
Just fine.
Scott, I have known you for over a decade now, and I have always admired your work ethic, your compassion, and also your hospitality. Now, looking back, you know, over the work you have done, being, you know, president, co-founder of an organization that's quite large, spanning, you know, numerous countries around the world, what has been one of the most inspiring moments for you?
Oh, well, it's difficult to single out a single inspiring moment. Throughout my career, I feel as if I've been moving from one exciting opportunity and challenge to another, and that's what keeps me going, I think. Having done this work for more than 30 years, I still find myself excited about new projects. So I don't really spend a lot of time looking back at the exciting moments. What I devote much more time to is looking ahead to upcoming deadlines and challenges. So at the moment, for instance, I'm preparing to do one of my first professional travels since the pandemic started, where I'll go to southern France for 10 days to participate in a nature writing festival with French and American writers. So it's moving from one opportunity like this to another that keeps me motivated and inspired. So it's very hard to pick out just a single moment from such a long history of interesting and exciting opportunities.
Hmm. You have interacted with a lot of students. You were always really welcoming to students, for example, me, and you always, you know, encouraged our work. One student we want to highlight today in our talk, I had her in a podcast. She's not a student anymore. She's the co-founder of a health app from Tanzania, and her name is Maria Kadushi. And I want to kind of dive into the subjects you're covering by using her as an example. So Maria Kadushi created this health app in order to promote health in Tanzania. And she always struggled with this, you know, Western perception of Africa and also how to, you know, draw people into her project. And she often encounters this compassion fatigue. What would you say, you know, to people when they ask you, how can I develop a more global understanding of contemporary environmental issues? How can I not succumb to compassion fatigue or other mental states that are not very helpful in order to get things done?
Yeah, well, that's a huge challenge. The possibility that our empathy may dissipate and not enable us to fully engage with situations that require our attention. When you mentioned earlier that I'm involved with this website called Arithmetic of Compassion, really that website is devoted to illuminating various psychological phenomena, psychological characteristics of the human brain that inhibit our compassion. And these include phenomena such as psychic numbing. That means our ability to focus on small scale and individual phenomena, and how quickly, how terribly, and even tragically quickly we lose our sense of engagement with phenomena that move beyond the number one. As soon as we start talking about two people, we care less, in a sense, than we care about a single person. And by the time we're talking about a larger community or a society that is facing certain challenges, the human brain really struggles to comprehend what that means. And so, in a sense, we're doomed to compassion fatigue. It's built into the way our brains function. This is what we explore in the website, arithmeticofcompassion.org. And my own role in this work is to think about how we might use certain communication strategies in order to present ideas, to tell stories that can somehow cut through the fatigue or the numbing that we're inclined to feel with large-scale phenomena. And so one of their various strategies that are used, and in fact, you know, communication experts tend to talk about the need to use multiple strategies in combination with each other, not just a single mode of presenting a situation or providing information, but to give the big picture, the large scale overview, but then to zero in tightly on an individual story in order to bring to life the larger phenomenon and to represent the genuine reality of human experience associated with the phenomenon in question. The danger is when we use only one mode or another, when we only tell the story, the individual story, and we don't back up and offer the bigger perspective and the more technical information in order to provide context for the story. And lately, I've been thinking about the danger of telling too many stories. We can feel a kind of compassion fatigue when we're inundated with one story after another story after another story. That leads to yet another type of weariness and inattention on the part of the human brain. In addition to our challenge, our psychological challenge, comprehending the large scale, we also have a limited attention span. We can only pay attention for a certain amount of time. And this is even those of us who are pretty good at paying attention. We're trained and we have a natural tendency to pay attention. Nonetheless, we're human beings and the human mind works in certain ways. But I was going to say also that to me, simply being aware of our psychological tendencies enables us to push back against some of these tendencies toward insensitivity. And so having a term like compassion fatigue or psychic numbing is valuable in that it enables us to see this phenomenon happening in our own minds when it's underway and to say, wait a minute, I need to overcome this. I need to pay more attention. I need to feel empathy when I feel my empathy beginning to wane. And also some similar tendencies that we mention on our website are phenomena such as pseudo-inefficacy, the feeling that I need not pay attention to this phenomenon because I can't do anything about it. It's too big, it's too global, or it's happening far away on some distant part of the planet, and I'm not a rich person, so I can't send a huge amount of money, or I can't control an agency of people to go in and intervene and overcome this problem. So what can I do? And this pseudo-inefficacy, as we call it, means a false sense of inefficacy, because when we collectively each do a small part, it can make a big difference. And so we need to be reminded that we actually do have power to contribute to solving big problems. And there are various other psychological phenomena that I can talk about, but I don't want to digress too far from your original question. So why don't I allow you to proceed with some questions?
Yeah, so in regards to, you know, telling stories, Maria Kadushi often referred to, this tree planting thing, you know, let's plant tree. And she's like, it's not even about planting trees, you know, it would be enough if we preserve trees. So as you said, maybe sometimes we have too many stories of things that getting done and things that, you know, have to be done, like planting trees. So what about preserving stuff? And here I want to come to the term slow violence, which in regards to trees, that sometimes certain environmental issues that lead to decline of forests and stuff. How would you frame tree planting versus preservation in the larger context?
Well, there are various parts to the question that you just asked. And I do believe that it's, in a sense, if we're thinking about carbon capture and the importance of maintaining forests in order to avoid contributing to global climate change, well, it's a mature, healthy forest is much more valuable, I believe, than many small seedlings that are newly planted. So it takes a long time for a newly planted seedling to become a large tree and to be contributing positively to the ecosystem. So tree planting is an important thing to do in order to compensate for some of the forests that we have cleared, but we shouldn't assume that tree planting alone is necessarily the solution to the problem of overcutting of trees, of deforestation. To me, one of the virtues of an activity such as tree planting is that it feels active. For those people who are involved in tree planting, it gives them a sense of active engagement with a situation that they see as a problem. And we have a tendency when we're told about certain ecological or humanitarian problems in the world to feel passive and powerless, and we don't want to engage at all. But when people give us small things to do, from tree planting to recycling, we at least feel as if we're doing something positive, something that you might call pro-social. And that might give us momentum, a sense of agency, which would enable us to do other things in our lives that are positive contributions, not absolute solutions to these large problems, but small positive contributions that can add up when they happen in concert with the activities of other people around the world. So, well, you mentioned slow violence earlier, and which of course is the idea that Rob Nixon articulated in his 2011 book, Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. This has become one of the major concepts in the environmental humanities. Many, many people refer to this because it describes so many of the large-scale concerns, the great problems that we have around the world. For me, one of the key aspects of Nixon's idea of slow violence is the idea that we struggle to perceive these destructive phenomena that are occurring because they're so large that our human senses cannot apprehend them. Apprehend is the word that Nixon himself uses. We struggle to apprehend, literally to grasp these phenomena. Our human senses cannot look out the window and see climate change. We cannot see extinction happening before our eyes. Likewise, many of these destructive problems are systemic. They're structural. They're embedded in the way our societies, our economies function. So you can't literally sense these. You have to learn about them through abstract information, through data and, you know, quantification, which also doesn't have much of an effect on us. When we read a technical article or look at a chart of some kind, it's not going to move us typically to engage and try to do something. So in a way, the technical information has to be translated into formats that might strike us on a human level. And so this problem of apprehension is a really profound one, and sometimes it seems to be an overwhelming one. But lately, I've been thinking not only about the problem of literally appreciating and perceiving these phenomena that might inspire concern. I'm thinking about urgency. It's one thing to know that these phenomena are occurring around the world, malnutrition and, you know, the spread of disease and things like that in the public health context, or climate change, habitat disappearance, extinction, the spread of toxicity, the spread of phenomena such as plastic, microplastics in the oceans and things like that. But how to compel audiences to feel a sense of urgency when they contemplate these phenomena. And so in the context of environmental texts and humanitarian texts, pieces of writing or other kinds of cultural products that might convey information, I'm also interested in how to convey a feeling of urgency that would inspire the public to act individually or to try to communicate with decision makers, corporate decision makers, government decision makers, non-governmental organizations, and inspire the kind of urgent action that seems to be needed given the crises that we face in the world right now.
Yeah, to come back to Maria Kudushi, she really took action in regards to healthcare in Tanzania by creating this app, which has also been awarded. So coming back to your term systemic, in regards to trees being cut down, that's very often used for cooking, for fuel, and that could be considered a systemic slow violence to forests. The most challenging aspect here, as you say, is how to communicate those large scale or as Timothy Morton calls it, hyper objects, which go beyond, you know, human understanding in time and space. What kind of stories, you know, talking about stories and how to communicate these things, have you found helpful besides of boiling it down to a person, which is sometimes difficult with those massive objects? Can you maybe give some other examples?
Well, often I find myself particularly inspired by stories of people who are compelled to see a problem and are compelled to act upon it, to try to be a problem solver or to try to reach out a helping hand in some way, or to experience a kind of revolution in their personal thinking and change their own behavior from a destructive type of behavior to another. I don't know if this is strictly in Western culture or if it's more universal, but the conversion experience, as I would call it, seems to be a deeply embedded trope in Western culture. And originally, it had a religious context, and conversion narratives were related to religious conversion, such as St. Augustine's Confessions, where he confesses being a sinful person as a young man, and then he has a revelation, an inspiration, and works toward a more saintly life, and then tells that story in a narrative where basically he changes directions. And I think conversion narratives told by people who were once not very nice people or destructive in their behavior and then had a change of
heart. Or maybe just not informed.
Not informed, or something happened to trigger a change of heart. And so one of my, I don't know if this is the best example to give you, but one of the texts that I find particularly beautiful and poignant in its representation of a change of heart is perhaps the single most famous environmental text in American literature. And this is a short essay by Aldo Leopold called Thinking Like a Mountain. It was written in the around 1918, 1919, early 20th century when he was a young forest ranger, natural resources ranger in Arizona and New Mexico. And he happened to encounter a pack of wolves. And at the time, he thought it was his job to shoot any predators he came across. And so he and his partner pulled out their rifles and began shooting these wolves. And then, you know, they hit a few of them and the others ran away. And they, as he tells the story in this short essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, he approached one of the injured wolves just as she was about to die. And as I tell this story, I hear my dog, who's like a wolf, barking in the background. But just as the wolf was dying, Aldo Leopold saw the fierce green fire in her eyes dying. And he describes this very eloquently and poetically, and then talks about how he realized his mistake. He realized at that moment what a problem it was to kill predators, because any healthy ecosystem requires predators to be, you know, harvesting the deer that are overpopulating and causing erosion and destroying other problems in the environment. So the story of Leopold's conversion from someone who reflexively killed every predator he saw to someone who understood that the goal of a healthy ecosystem requires restraint in human behavior is not only compelling because of the specific messages about predators in healthy ecosystems, to me it's compelling because it shows a profound change of heart that leads to a change of behavior. And to me, that's a model for other kinds of changes of heart that any of us can have about using petroleum-fueled vehicles, using plastic bottles, you know, traveling frequently to conferences when we can do virtual meetings and accomplish much of our work in that way. There are so many small aspects of our own lives that we can actually adjust and calibrate to the conditions of the world if we understand the possibility of such conversion. And so, you know, many people may be aware of issues in the world that require attention. They just don't realize that they have the potential in their own lives to make certain behavioral adjustments that will really make a difference. So early in my career, I was interested in awareness. Wrote my first book is called Seeking Awareness in American Nature Writing. And my feeling then was that we needed to raise the level of awareness of what's happening in the world. I actually feel that today in 2022, we have a very high level of awareness. Information is readily available to us. And still, look at all the problems we have in the world. So awareness is not enough. We need to convey to people a sense of urgency and a sense that we each have the power within us to make certain types of changes, certain types of contributions that, you know, are meaningful.
In 2020, two books are going to come out, one Nature and Literary Studies, and the other one, the Bloomsbury Handbook to Medical Environmental Humanities. What are the key messages you want to convey in these books? I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about this now. Maybe talk about these books and what kind of information people will find in there once they can buy it.
Yeah, well, so the Cambridge Critical Concepts series has asked a colleague of mine, Peter Ramin, and I to do this comprehensive collection on the concept of nature as explored through quote-unquote literary studies. Because I say quote-unquote because it's not only strictly literary texts, poetry and novels and things like that, but other kinds of media expressions, you know, the human experience in relation to nature. And that's a more traditional scholarly book that attempts to take a very historical approach from medieval and early modern representations of nature in cultural texts, all the way up to digital representations and the idea that nature is not something outside of ourselves, but that we possess nature within ourselves, that, you know, the material world of nature is embodied in our own lives. It's not something external to us. So we progress from a very pre-modern sensibility toward nature and cultural expression up to a very contemporary and post-postmodern idea of the meaning of nature in human experience as represented in cultural texts. So that particular book, Nature and Literary Studies, is a somewhat traditional scholarly collection attempting to take stock of the way writers, artists, scholars throughout a long period of history, not only in Western culture, but in some other parts of the world, such as South Asia and East Asia and Africa, have attempted to contemplate our relationship to other aspects of nature. But the book that you also mentioned, the Bloomsbury Handbook to Medical Environmental Humanities, which is also coming out this summer, that's an effort to bring together two different bodies of scholarship, the medical humanities and the environmental humanities, which many of us have long sensed had something to say to each other, but have typically existed as parallel and independent bodies of thought. And so we've attempted with a large group of scholars from many, many different parts of the world to consider a variety of aspects of the intertwining of the health of the planet and the health of human individuals and human communities. So there's a whole section devoted to public health issues as environmental issues, contaminated water in Flint, Michigan, and you know, which is an enormous environmental justice and public health crisis, but it's also related to environmental contamination. And so rather than simply referring to it as a strictly human crisis, what might change if we contemplate it as an issue of unhealthy environment in which people inhabit? And, you know, how might forces be brought together, environmental activists and public health activists or advocates, to work together to solve both of these problems in tandem rather than to separate the environmental concerns and the human concerns? There are also several pieces in that book focusing on traditional medical ideas in different cultures around the world. There are several pieces. My co-editors for that book, Swarnalata Rangaranjan and Vidya Sarveswaran, are both from India. And so we have several pieces on South Asia focusing on traditional concepts of medicine, such as Ayurvedic medicine in India, which have a lot to do with ideas of the natural world, but also are essentially concerned with maintaining and restoring human health. There are also chapters on Latin American traditional environmental ideas and various kinds of African ideas, particularly from West Africa, the Nigeria region or the Niger Delta, and how have artistic texts, literary texts, represented traditional African medicine, traditional Amazonian medicine. And in the case of another contribution to that book, there's a piece on traditional Chinese medicine as both a set of environmental ideas and as wisdom pertaining to human health. And then in addition, there's a tendency as a reflex to think about health as a physical phenomenon, but what about the psychological aspects of health? And so a number of the pieces in this book focus on the relationship between environmental experience and human mental health, such as the connection between human depression, the experience of depression, and the eco-recovery memoir, and which is particularly a genre in the United Kingdom. And there are a number of memoirs by people who are experiencing certain types of psychological trauma, such as the loss of a person that they love, and how a path toward recovery has occurred by way of interacting with other species. I'm thinking of Helen MacDonald's famous book, H's for Hawk, which is a very popular book and an example of what one of the contributors to this handbook describes as an eco-recovery memoir. And then there's another book on madness and geographical displacement, and how sometimes extreme mental agitation occurs as a result of physical dislocation or geographical dislocation. And the contributor of that chapter is focusing on Irish literature and madness, but also doing so within the context of our relationship to place, and how sense of place, it's not just an aesthetic idea that you can enjoy some places more than you enjoy other places. It actually has to do with our very well-being and whether we feel stable psychologically or somehow destabilized and unsettled and unable to function very well as a result of our physical situation. So anyway, there are many different approaches, many different angles, but the idea is to start or to jumpstart a conversation between medical and environmental humanists. And three of us who coordinated this project, my colleagues Swarna and Vidya from India and I, we are very self-conscious of the fact that we worked on this project during the COVID-19 pandemic, a time when all of our lives have been shaken up by, you know, this public health crisis that has been global. And so those of us who had felt relatively secure in our good health, all of us were on edge and worried about the precarity that we were facing, the vulnerability and our susceptibility to this disease. And it was actually a perfect time to be newly sensitized to the fact that health and safety and, you know, our relationships with other species should be a concern for all people. And so we mentioned this in the introduction in detail and also in the epilogue that all three of us wrote separate parts for. As I discussed, it's hard to overlook the fact that having done this kind of work for more than 30 years, I'm getting older than I once was. And I tend to be a very energetic and enthusiastic and forward-looking person. But at the time when I was finishing up the manuscript for the Medical Environmental Humanities Handbook, I had a running injury. I'd been running too much and my legs were hurting me, and I became acutely aware of mortality and the fact that I couldn't run in the same way that I could when I was younger. And so in my part of the epilogue to the book, I wrote about how when we lose something that we took for granted, we care much more about it. And I referred to Joni Mitchell's famous song, Big Yellow Taxi, which she wrote at the time of the first Earth Day in 1970. And there's a famous line in there, "You don't know what you got till it's gone." And I think that is a very profound, it's spoken in jargon and or in vernacular. And it sounds like a simple idea, but it's a really profound way of thinking about our relationship to the more than human world, which we take for granted until it's gone or we see it disappearing. And the same thing is true of human health. We can take our own good health and that of our fellow citizens for granted until it's gone, until we're living through a pandemic, until we have age-related athletic injuries, or until we're exposed to some kind of environmental toxin or danger that makes us realize, oh, we shouldn't have taken a safe environment for granted. And so, you know, my hope is that a book like this will inspire my fellow scholars. It's mostly going to be scholars who read it, but maybe other people who become aware of the profound intersection between environmental health and human health to really think about these as being mutually supportive concepts, that you can't have one without the other. If you care about human beings, then it's probably also important to care about the more than human environment.
So I noticed that you also was talking about pandemic literature. Is that part of the book?
Yes, I would say pandemic literature is part of the Handbook to Medical Environmental Humanities. There are several chapters focusing on pandemic novels, or there's one on the imagination of viruses. What is the meaning of a virus in various cultural texts throughout history? So I was not even aware of the genre of plague literature or pandemic literature till the pandemic started. And like so many other people around the world, I began watching pandemic movies and reading. Well, I'd read The Plague when I was many, many years younger, but I never really thought of Albert Camus' The Plague or La Peste as a pandemic novel. But now I recognize it as being part of a much larger group of literary texts that are concerned with large-scale disease. It's like Mary Shelley's The Last Man. And I tend to be a specialist in more contemporary literature. And
you know what really struck me? Heart of Redness by Saïx Mda. I have read that a number of times and I've looked at it. And only during the pandemic, I realized it's also about pandemic. which even started kind of in the Alps. So quite interesting to research that part of the novel, which never ever occurred to me.
Yeah, even very familiar literature that may have been interesting to us for other reasons, we look at it through a different lens when we're living through a pandemic ourselves. The book that I was trying to think of a moment ago is Geraldine Brooks' novel, Year of Wonders, which came out around 2001. And it's about a 17th century plague in a village in rural England. And it's a very beautiful and painful representation of the way a community struggles with disease and the way certain individuals are persecuted as witches or as the perpetrators of the pandemic or of the epidemic. And one of the things that struck me in Brooks' novel, Year of Wonders, is how even during a time of great struggle and distress, there are beautiful moments of understanding or of people coming together to support each other. And so there are these glimmers of epiphany or, you know, literally wonderment, even in the darkest times. And comparable to that, with the emphasis on occasional moments of wonderment, is a 2012 novel by the American author Peter Heller called The Dog Stars, which takes place in the aftermath of an influenza epidemic that kills most of the people in society. And he lives by himself with his dog in the mountains of Colorado, the narrator of The Dog Stars. And he is a pilot of a small airplane, and he flies above the landscape, looking down at the beautiful, quiet landscape, which doesn't have many people or vehicles moving around in it. And everything seems wonderful, almost Edenic. And then he comes down to earth and he realizes he's all alone. Even his wife has died. And, so he's isolated. And when occasionally he does encounter other people, they're very dangerous to him because they're coming to steal from him, to take whatever resources he has in order to secure their own survival. So The Dog Stars vacillates between these moments of beauty and, you know, a sense of great peacefulness and a sense of extreme isolation and risk. So I've been doing some writing about pandemic literature, and I'm actually interested in conducting some empirical studies, working together with social scientists and doing what scholars like me are now calling empirical eco-criticism, to actually collect data on the way audiences respond to environmental texts. I'm interested in using pandemic texts as a way of infecting people with a sense of healthy precarity, if that makes any sense. I'm wondering whether reading about people's sense of extreme vulnerability during pandemics might entice readers or inspire readers to feel an accentuated sense of their own vulnerability that spreads beyond the context of disease, so that they can realize, oh, you know, in many ways, all of our lives are somewhat precarious. And it would be good for us to be mindful, to be careful in the way we use natural resources, in the way we, you know, behave in other kinds of contexts, in order to protect the environment and human beings. So I'd like to do some work on pandemic literature and the way it might, so to speak, infect us with a sense of healthy precarity.
What struck me about this South African novel I just mentioned, Heart of Redness, is how he talks about conspiracy theories, how people come up with all kinds of reasons for why things happen. And while reading that, I realized, you know, it's just kind of the human condition that some of us develop conspiracy theories in order to, you know, understand or try to understand what's going on. So I found that novel very helpful while, you know, following the news.
That's a great example. I would say, you know, there's an article in the Medical Environmental Handbook that I was talking about by my colleague, Jaru Chang, who's Taiwanese, but she teaches at Brooklyn College in New York. And her article is on the concept of the scapegoat in the context of the pandemic. And there's also a human tendency whenever there's some kind of social problem to try to look for the cause so as to externalize that cause. So rather than taking personal responsibility, we're inclined to say, oh, it's that other group of people, such as Chinese people, or it's another species. So scapegoatism, as she puts it, in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, was applied to people of Chinese descent and to certain types of animals, the pangolin in particular and the bat. And one of the reasons for doing this is just to push aside the cause and not really deal with it and not realize that there may very well be many other pandemics in the future. So you can't just say it's the fault of the bat or the pangolin or the Chinese. There may be many other types of pandemics to worry about. We need to be aware of the phenomenon of zoonosis and to realize that our relationships with other species have significant consequences for human beings in general, not just to find one limited scapegoat for one particular pandemic.
So talking about future, quite a few of our listeners are young people who might at the moment might be trying to find out what they should study or in what direction they should go. So I found, you mentioning these books were helpful because some listeners might think, oh, you know, maybe this is the direction I want to study or want to get more information. So thank you so much for giving us an insight in that. In one interview I found on YouTube, there are so many interviews. So to the listeners, in case you want to find out more about Scott Slavik, there are a lot of very interesting YouTube talks available. And in one of them, you mentioned that you're interested in the human cultural expression more broadly in regards to environmental humanities. I found that a very nice summary of what you're doing. How do you think that students can get a better understanding of the human cultural expression more broadly? What would you advise the next generation, the people who might have to handle other pandemics and other, have to handle large-scale environmental issues? Anything, you want to conclude this podcast with?
I would say, as you contemplate your education, be prepared to be flexible. Be prepared to change direction, not just during your initial studies, but throughout your life, throughout your career. Be prepared to be nimble and flexible and be open to new ideas. And that really has been one of the key aspects of my own experience, not to say to people, well, my training is in the study of poetry. I went to the university and I learned how to read poetry very well. In fact, I was trained to study traditional literature, but now I study many different types of cultural texts. I write about film. I write about scientific articles as forms of human cultural expression. And, I'm interested now in information as much as I am in particular cultural traditions of textual expression. So rather than simply locking myself into a particular framework, I've tried to be nimble and flexible, and it's opened up a lot of interesting and important possibilities for me. So wherever you start in your educational path, be prepared to move in different directions as interesting opportunities arise for you, and don't simply close the door.
I really liked how you said that in 1995 you had to create and then led the center, or one of the first Center for Environment and Arts and Humanities, and it lasted for only 5 years. And at some point you thought, is that a failure or is it not? And I think today you think it was not a failure. It was a very enriching experience. So that would maybe be an example where you were very flexible and give it a try and learned a lot from it.
Right, exactly. I think that's a really good point, Heidi. And often we engage in certain types of activities and we think that longevity is the main goal, to continue it as long as possible, without realizing that sometimes institutions like an academic center or journals or other kinds of projects may have a lifespan. And I think that center that I directed back in the late 90s and early 2000s may very well have inspired many other centers in different universities and different parts of the world. And so, I think there is a sort of a seed planting aspect to this. If an idea is good, it will begin to germinate and it will have a life beyond itself. And if an idea is somehow evolutionarily weak and not worthy to continue, then it won't necessarily continue. So just have to be prepared to experience that kind of thing in your life. And don't let it discourage you from starting other kinds of projects.
I think that's a very nice conclusion. Let's plant seeds, see what happens. Thank you so much for coming. And I just want to mention during our conversation that you kept reaching back in your bookshelf, pulling out books, something not visible in a podcast, but I thought that was a very charming gesture. Just wanted to mention that. So I wish you good luck with your future projects. I'm looking forward to meeting you somewhere on the planet at some point, hopefully in real life. That is a different feeling still. I'm not a totally virtual person yet.
Yeah, but virtual is better than nothing. It's very good to talk with you.
It is. So good to see you.
Yeah, have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Today, we talked to Scott Slovik. If you want to learn more about his work, please check the show notes. If you're interested in Maria Kadusch's work, her health app, the link between health and environment, or her opinion on Friday for Future in regards to Africa, please listen to our podcast with her. We say thank you to Scott and Maria for allowing us to link them in this podcast series. Please feel free to contact them or us. Let's keep planting seeds by sharing insights, ideas, and visions.